Remind me to pass out the homeworks, which I've printed out for you at the end of the at the end of today's lecture. So the papers I've been assigning have been mostly to get you to read the literature, because the what we're talking about is not so much about it in the text, or it sort of comes to life more, the methods, when you read a paper in the literature. And you know, and you have to read them because you'll be asked about them on the final. We're not talking about them very much. But like, for instance, the paper for today, which was not necessary to read for today, is just one more method added to the methods of RNA analysis that I'll talk about, that you could read about on your own. It's a very short paper and a very recent technology. But the paper for next time, for next Monday, I would like you to read carefully and think about the methods involved and formulate questions if you have, and I'll go over it in detail next time. I use this paper every year. It's from 1992, but it has it just shows how a company, a biotechnology company, can uses just a variety of tools to towards the end of making a better therapeutic protein. And it's I think it's very educational in terms of all the methods, the various methods they bring together in one project. So please read. This is a paper by Rice, and it's posted now. Okay, so we have sort of a loose organization here in which we're getting expression of genes in cells, from E. coli to yeast to mammalian cells. And we talked somewhat about promoter, investigating transcriptional mechanisms via defining promoters last time. And today we'll talk about looking at the results of gene expression, how you measure gene expression, both at the level of RNA, and to some extent on proteins. And then if we have time, we'll talk about also protein-protein interactions, having major proteins. So these are the methods we'll talk about here on graphic one, starting with the classical methods at the top, and then going to more and more modern methods. So northern blotting is one of the oldest. I think you all know the origin of why it's called northern blotting. Who doesn't know why it's called northern blotting? Okay. Who doesn't know why southern blotting is called southern blotting? You all know about Ed Southern. Okay. So northern blotting is kind of a joke name, and it's. It's still in some ways you don't see it used much anymore, but it in some ways it's a sort of a gold standard, silver standard now maybe, compared to RNA-seq. But basically, like southern blotting, it involves separation of molecules according to their size on a gel. These are agarose gels, and transfer to the blotting part, transferring out of the gel onto a membrane, a sort of a plastic-like membrane, like nitrocellulose or nylon, and where you has access then to reagents that you'll treat it with. And the main reagent you're treating with then is a specific probe. You have all the RNA in the cell spread out here, and you look for your particular message or messages using a radioactively labeled probe for the sequence of that RNA. And after it's hybridized, then you expose to X-ray film, and you can visualize where it is, from which you can get the molecular weight, and how much it is, which you can get from the intensity. So I'm using a few results from our own lab. This is a gene you hear a lot about in this course, the hydrofolate reductase. This is the messenger RNA for the hydrofolate reductase in CHO cells. You can see there's two bands, and that's because there's two different polyadenylation sites. You can also see they're quite different in size, over 1,000 bases different in sizes, one species with a really long 3' untranslated region and one with a very short one. And then there's a third one that's much less, but definitely present, of an intermediate size. The estimation of molecular weight is compromised by the fact that the size in a native gel, by the fact that the RNA can form secondary and tertiary structures and fold up. And depending on how it folds up, it would have more or less mobility through this gel. The more compact forms going faster than you might think for the molecular weight. And so if you really want to know the molecular weight, then you can run a denaturing gel where shape is not a, where all of the hydrogen bonding is destroyed by very high concentrations of either urea or formamide, and so all the RNA is migrating like a random coil. Perhaps better quantitation is obtained by RNase protection. This you still see used sometimes, and this is still probably for a regular kind of experiment you can do in the lab is the gold standard for quantifying the amount of RNA you have. So in this case, you take in this particular experiment taken just from a website. Has a wild type versus a mutated version of the RNA. But basically, you make a highly radioactive cDNA fragment from the complementary to the mRNA sequence, or it can be an RNA fragment made by a T7 RNA transcription in the test tube. You make RNA-RNA hybrids, which are actually even more stable than RNA-DNA hybrids or DNA-DNA hybrids, right? Duplexes. And then you anneal it, and then you digest with RNase, let's say, if you have an RNA probe. So if you use the right RNases, like RNase A and T1, I think it is, they will digest, they have a preference of pyrimidines or purines. If you use both of them, then you have much less preference, but they won't digest double-stranded RNA, only single-stranded RNA. And so your radioactive probe here, which is this hatched rectangle, will get all destroyed in this region which doesn't correspond to the mRNA. Let's say you put in this extra piece, and then so that the piece that's left, you can predict the size, so you know it's coming from the right place, and you put it on a gel. It's always nice. You should always have a probe that's bigger than the digested form, so that you're sure that you're seeing protection, that you're seeing digestion of the single-stranded part. So you have the highest molecular weight fragment that you can see would be the undigested probe, and then after digested, you should see it degrade. If you have a single base change, this could be, although not 100% sure, but the enzyme could be good enough to recognize this as single-stranded, even with a single base change, and cut your probe opposite the mismatch, in which case you would see two bands instead of the expected one band, and you can even know what their sizes are. You can pinpoint a mutation in or a base difference between your probe and the mRNA. So without going through a whole RNA-seq, this is one way you can pinpoint mutations. We used this technique extensively before, in the old days, right? Before RT-PCR, actually. Maybe not before RT-PCR, but mapping mutations. Without having to clone the genes and sequencing them. In the case of, so this is called RPA, RNase protection analysis. You can look at, for instance, at mutants that don't splice. Then it's very easy because you have a big mismatched area here, and so that gets, it's easier to degrade across such a major change, and you get like two fragments instead of one. So So there's actual data showing a DHFR mRNA that's got 4, 5, 6 exon, a fragment after RNA treatment that corresponds to size of 4, 5, 6, and another that corresponds to size of 1, 2. Much dimmer. I don't know why we always got that. The 5' end, the 5' piece was always dimmer. And nothing for exon 3. And so we knew exon 3 was missing in these. And then we used also RT-PCR to confirm it. So none of this depends on amplification, which is the compromise of the quantitation of these nucleic acids, because you're never sure that the efficiency of amplification isn't a little bit off, and a little bit off on the exponential nature of PCR gives you a big error in the end. With the advent of qPCR and other methods we'll talk about later, this is less of a problem, but it's still in some ways easier to do it this way. And while we're talking about it, we could mention ways, related methods, in which you map the where the transcription start site is for your mRNA by hybridizing a radioactive complement to the mRNA at some point downstream of the transcription start site, and then add DNA polymerase, like the clean-out fragment of DNA polymerase, which has no 5' exoactivity. So, and extend as far as you can, and then look at the longest thing that you got, right? So, in this case, we have actually 6 bands that you can see in this lane. For the extension of this, again, this is DHFR mRNA. So the major start here at band 3. And then a quite substantial start, turns out to be about 15% at band 1, and then in a better exposure you can see some of these subbands, which are probably just the clean out falling off and may not be biologically relevant. But these two are both biologically relevant, and in fact you can see a promoter upstream of this site and another promoter SP1 box for a transcription factor binding site upstream of this box. So that's called primer extension. The more modern way of doing en masse, like all the 5' ends, you could do at once, in fact, a procedure called CAGE, which is not actually mentioned here, but CAGE involves this method of cap trapping. CAGE is something like cap trapping analysis of promoter or a gene, something, I don't know. But it's to give you a library of molecules from the transcriptome, from the RNA in the cell, the 5' ends. Because all the early libraries used a ligand DT to extend and make cDNA, and they were highly biased towards the 3' end. So to make sure you had real transcripts, it's good to go to the 5' end. And it has an interesting strategy about it. So an mRNA molecule will have at its 5' end, of course, a cap, the 7-methylguanine, that's backwardsly attached to the first base, and with various degrees of methylation on this ribose, and one on the guanine as well, I think. But what it will have sort of distinctively at the 5' end is, because it's going in backwards, it has this diol. It has a 2 hydroxyls of ribose, which has naturally two hydroxyls. In DNA, you'd have only one, but in RNA, you have these 2 hydroxyls, which makes it a reactive sugar, and that's why RNA is so labile. But one of these hydroxyls is used to make the phosphodiester bond of the polymer of RNA, and so none of these internal guys have this diol characteristic. Only this backwards put on cap ribose. At the other end, at the 3' end, where things are finally finished, then you have, again, a 3' hydroxyl waiting for more synthesis, but polyadenylation has stopped, so you have this poly-A stretch. So down here, you also have this diol. So the molecule has 2 diols at its 2 ends. Now, if you have this diol structure, then by doing some chemistry, you can attack you can attach a biotin, appropriately modified biotin molecules, it's just over here, with the right reactive group, take advantage of this reactivity. You see its ring is being opened up here. And so you can selectively biotinylate just the two ends by subjecting your RNA preparation to this chemistry. Okay, it's a lot on this slide. But it's straightforward if you go through it little by little. So let's say the first step then is you make cDNA from the mRNA, right, by using oligo-DT. And notice here there's an X, right? So sometimes you can use you can use a primer that has an A over here, or let's say not an A is a bad choice. A. If an A was over here, then there would have to be a T over here. And it would only be able to extend those mRNAs that have a T as the last coded base before the polyadenylation site. So if you add all four, then you're covered, right? But what it means is that you only extend right up at the joint between the poly A part and the coding part if you put an extra base and you put all four of them and just mix them all together. So you have this X, TTTTT primer, and then you have a tail that has a restriction site in it. So this will cuddle up right to the end of the coding section and it will go along. I don't know what these CH3s are. But and so some of them will go all the way to the cap. The problem is that many of them don't get that far because the reverse transcriptase falls off. Right? And you want the sequence at the cap. So once you have this mixture of this of the top type and the bottom type here, in graphic 6, then you can treat that with RNase 1. So RNase 1 will cleave the single-stranded RNA. So as a result, if it didn't get to the end, it'll cleave off the single-stranded RNA and therefore break the connection of this duplex molecule now between the cap and it. So you've lost this biotinylated site. Over on the other biotinylated site, which is at the 3' end, that following the poly A, is also single-stranded because, after all, you only used a 13-mer or something, or 18-mer. Of oligo-DTs followed by a specific base, and so that's hanging off single-stranded also, so that gets cleaved off too. So that molecule, I just put fresh batteries in this, that molecule then gets shorn of both cap structures. The can't reach that high. Whereas the molecule that is extended all the way to the end is not a substrate for the RNAs. It doesn't cleave right within that triple phosphate cap structure. Right? So the cap is left on here, but it surely is still cleaved from the 3' end. So the full-length ones then are the only ones left with biotin. So you capture them with magnetic beads coated with avidin. They'll bind the biotin. And you can wash away all these incomplete molecules. Now you can treat with RNA that does not depend on single-strandedness and get rid of all the RNA entirely. So you're left with the cDNA. Or you could treat with high base that also gets rid of RNA and leaves DNA intact. And now you can extend this 3' end with, which is now on the left because this is cDNA, with poly G, say, and then use oligo C and let's say another restriction site. I believe there should be another restriction site on there. Maybe it's further away. And finally cleave with the XHO and the other restriction site, and you have your very nice full-length molecule. So this is a way to give full-length clones. I'll try another battery. No? Well, a few more minutes we'll have on it. Okay, so now we skip to very modern technology, which is a digital readout of mRNA. And one way is this nanostring technology, which is one particular company. It's quite ingenious. So here's how this works. You have, imagine here, a particular, and this is going in for particular mRNAs, right, as all of these are. So you make synthetically two molecules that can specifically recognize this mRNA. So they have regions of complementarity. On one, there's a so-called capture probe that has some repeated sequences, quite long, I think around, well, I'm not sure how long these are. These are about 900. No, these are 900. Anyway, it's got this region which is common to all the molecules you're going to make. Because you're going to not just do one mRNA, you could do many RNAs. The limit right now is about 800. So you can make 800 of these, which cost you because you have to make these 800 specific probes, 1600 really specific probes. So this is not cheap. On the other side, again, you have this the reporter. So one's going to capture it and one's going to report on it. And you're reporting on this specific mRNA because it has this specific sequence as well. And attached to it are regions, long regions, 900 base regions of RNA segments that have been made with different fluorescent molecules attached to them, such that of six different colors. There should be six different colors. Here I see only five, but maybe there's a difference between these. They both look red, maybe one's purple. Actually, two look blue also. No, it depends. Yes, it depends. So they have different ones, different colors to play with, but they make a specific sequence. This is like a barcode, right? So if you have red, blue, green, yellow, blue, red, green, then that means that molecule was attached to this particular sequence. This particular sequence had that combination in this order. So you can imagine, even if they only had, that looks like four different colors, but they have seven different positions, that you can make a lot of different codes. Attached to the end of that are, again, some repeated sequences. Now you anneal all this together, and then you have a surface which has an avidin surface, to which has been seeded with a lawn of biotin-related molecules that are complementary to the capture, to the common capture sequence. So all of these guys are going to be captured, and they'll have different mRNAs acting as bridges to the reporter, which is going to have a color sequence that, you know, pretty long, a pretty good signal, like 900. So it's got lots of fluorescent molecules in it. It's not like that helicase thing with you have to detect one, right? But they're in a particular order. Of course, they're all crumpled up, so it's hard to see what's going on. But the next step, after you have this state where everything is attached, now you apply an electric field across this surface. So from minus to plus, so all the negatively charged nucleic acid is pulled this way, but it's anchored by its attachment site to the biotin-related complementary sequence that's complementary to the capture probe. And then you have mix in biotin-related sequence complementary to the other end, that those 5' repeats. So when this thing sticks down, it now hybridizes to this biotin-related thing, and the biotin-related thing hits the avidin surface and goes down. So this is their way of stretching it out. And they get a result that looks like this is all false color, of course. But so it looks, you know, better than... But the fact is that they can see. They can see over here you had one that was yellow, blue, red, green, red. So what's that? Oh, that's hexokinase, right? Hexokinase 1. Right. And this one's blue, blah, 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 blah. That's P53. You write that down, P53. And you do this for 800 different ones, and you do it for millions of them. So you get very good statistics, and you're essentially counting all the mRNA molecules. You get a digital readout of that RNA without having to go through sequencing the whole genome if you're only interested in 800 genes or 100 genes. So that's kind of a neat technology. Right now they could do 2100, but they're limited by other reasons to 800. They hope to increase that. More recently, about 2005, but it's starting to get adopted, is a cytogenetic way of looking inside cells, and that's the paper I had to look at, where you can just count the mRNA molecules, not 800 at a time like this, but two or three at a time, or one at a time, by just reliably hybridizing to each mRNA molecule in the cell with a particular color and counting the dots and doing many cells. So that gives you additional information about cellular heterogeneity and in terms of expression of your gene. And that's the Tiagi paper. And this is now being used in Marty Chalfie's lab looking at worms. Now perhaps the latest, I don't know, they had a show here about a month ago. I went. It's at some hotel downtown. And they had nice hors d'oeuvres and very slick brochures. And they were trying to promote their machine, which does PCR in a new way. And it's good for RT-PCR as well, so I include it here. And the trouble is it was a very expensive machine, which I complained about. And then about 2 weeks later, it was reported they were bought by Bio-Rad, which is a big laboratory equipment and reagent company. So it's now called, it was called something else. Now it's called the QX100. And this is also a neat idea. So the trouble with PCR is this business of the plateau is reached, and you don't know the efficiency. So there's just a little bit of, even with the qPCR, and the qPCR is also an expensive machine, and you have to do a lot of calibration and all this and that. They say there's a simpler way of doing things. And this kind of technology involves chemistry or biochemistry in emulsions, water and oil emulsions, and it can be used for many things. And this is a nice use of it. So what they spent a lot of time on was, I talked to the developers and they said, what was the biggest problem? The biggest problem was this, using some kind of microfluidic device that they could sell to you, and that you can do it, that will mix water and oil, and the water part is a PCR reaction mixture, with everything in it, the enzymes, everything. So you enclose them, these are the aqueous microspheres, right, in an oil background. Mineral oil. And their microfluidic device, now you can make this just by shaking it like salad dressing, or you can make it in this microfluidic device, which gives you very uniform microspheres. So that's an advantage, although not absolutely necessary. So they make a large number, millions, I guess, of these microspheres. And then when you do it, you want to say, let's say you have some cDNA that's been made from your RNA, because I'm giving you this in the context of RNA, but you can also use it, they use it for both. So you have this cDNA mixture, and you include it in the mixture so that your template, and with primers, and then the template is included in these microspheres. But you use a limiting amount of this template so that a lot of the microspheres don't even get a template. And those that get a template get usually one template. Right? Of course, by chance, many will get also two templates. Right? And there'll be a substantial number that get three templates. So how are you going to tell the difference? If you want to, know how many templates there are in your certain dilution, so you can calculate how much RNA you had before the RT, etc. So you take advantage of the Poisson distribution that says if the average number, say, is, let's say if the average number is 10, you don't know how much you have, right? So you just make a dilution and you have like 10 templates on the average per microsphere. Then you run this in a PCR reaction, and you get the PCR inside the emulsion. So this is similar, actually, to what the 454 also makes its beads inside this emulsion. So, if you have an average of 10, so almost all the microspheres are going to have at least one, almost all, but not all. According to Poisson, there will be some that still got zero, even though there were 10. So you just, after the PCR is done, you run the PCR to completion. You don't care about efficiency. You don't care about plateaus. You just run it all the way. And you put in cyber green. So those guys that amplified have it intercalate into double-strand DNA, so it's more fluorescent. So you have a background fluorescence here. There's a microsphere coming through. That was not amplified, and if it's amplified, you have much more fluorescence. So you just say 0, 1, 1, 0, 1. The 1 just means 1 or more. You don't care if you had 10 or 20 that started, they all reach the plateau. And from the Poisson distribution, which is this, says if you have, if your average occurrence is lambda, and the probability is F. This is what you measure in the end. You want to know K, I think. No, so K equals zero. Yeah. What's the probability, what is your proportion in the end that had no templates, if you start with K templates on average. So you measure F, and then you calculate K. But you can't tell the difference if this is 1 or 2 or 3, but if K is 0, then this formula reduces to lambda to the 0 divided by 0 factorial. Those are both 1, and so you're left with e to the minus lambda, and lambda is then this average number of templates, which is what you want. You want to know what's the average number of templates, and you get it by the frequency of those microspheres that have no that got no templates. And so you get these numbers, and they showed all kinds of wonderful graphs comparing it to qPCR. It's right on the button. Right? So the trouble is, so you have a machine that makes the microspheres, and you put your PCR mixed in, and then they have another machine that reads it, and you supply your own PCR machine. Just run it in your own 96-well PCR machine. So I like this technology. The trouble is, I wanted $75,000 for this. I'm not going to buy one from my lab. Maybe Bio-Rad will be cheaper. Also, you could do it yourself, basically. I was thinking, you know, so you can make them different size, but in the average, it'll come out the same way. It'll be a little more slop in the system. And then you could detect it by just looking in the microscope and counting those that are dim and those that are bright. And there are computer programs that will do that. And pattern recognition and look for the edges, and they're free from the NIH, but we probably won't do it. While we're talking about these machines, let's talk about the bioanalyzer, which has been around quite a while, and most labs don't have them, but those that do are always smiling. So this is a this is an electrophoresis machine, and it can tell you how much cDNA or RNA or PCR product, say, from an RT-PCR reaction. How much you have, you can quantify it, as well as tell you the length. So you can get the same thing from a gel. You run the gel, you stain it with thallium bromide, you take a picture, and then you run a program that looks at the luminance of your JPG image, and it will tell you. But this does it all in one step, and presumably more accurately, or reportedly more accurately. So you run the electrophoresis not on a gel, but on a microchip, which is disposable and pricey, of course. So I think that you have 12 samples, and you can put in one. And it runs in little channels. It's actually a little bit of gel in each channel. And then it has a detector that as the molecules then run through this channel, they run past the detector, it looks at the fluorescence. They have a dye in there. It's just some proprietary dye, not thorium bromide. So there's your first band, then your second band, third band, fourth band, fifth band. These are fuzzier bands, right? And the software associated with the machine, you have to attach a computer to it, calculates the area under the curve. You can go in fact, and say, well, this is some kind of background. I want to just measure the peak from down here. And it allows you to put marks in. Very nice. And so you don't have to run gels anymore. You just have this machine. They are gels, but there's these little microgels. Trouble is, if you only have 4 samples, you have to waste, $5 on or $12, whatever it is, for each. You might wait until you have 12 samples to be economical. And if you have 13 samples, you feel very bad. So it's a little clumsy in that respect. But one of our collaborators has it, and it's such a, so nice to see the results. I was talking to one of my colleagues about it, who's a real bug on quantification, right? And a real biophysicist. And so I was telling him how great this machine was. We used it for about a month in our lab, and returned it. And he said, well, really like to see the gel. I feel better about it. I said, I can't believe it. He said, this is better than a gel. And so, but the program realizes there are people like this, which I call the Luddites, which don't want to see the change, and they will give you a virtual gel. Take this and make it different colors, and you can see the fatter bands over here. This fat band. Okay. So that's everything I know about detecting RNA, almost. So now let's take up the question of looking at protein-protein interactions. And there'll be sort of two types. One is in vitro and one is in vivo. And the in vivo has a couple of advantages. One is just a technical one, which is the yeast-2 hybrid system, which we'll discuss in detail. And it's just making use of the yeast cells to tell you something about, say, human proteins interacting with each other. And the other kind of in vivo is actually in mammalian cells, so it's providing an environment that is closer to reality for seeing the protein-protein interaction taking place in the face of all the other competing molecules that are really present in the type of cells you're looking at. So let's take this yeast-2 hybrid system. It's very powerful. So it can be used in two ways. One is to discover, you have your target protein, you want to know what it interacts with, so you can look at as many different proteins as you can conjure up, as we'll see, and test thousands of them in one fell swoop against against yours, and you'll be able to pick out the 1 or 2 or 20 that interact with your protein. The other way is a more analytical approach in which you have, you're asking specifically, will X react, bind to Y? And so you set up your experiment and you put it in the yeast, and if you have that they do interact, you get one kind of result. If they don't interact, you get another kind of result. So how does it work? It works by making use of turning on genes, using the protein-protein interaction to turn on genes. And then the genes, you pick the genes that are useful for easily measuring whether the gene has been turned on and off or how much it's been turned on. So it's set up like this. First, if we had a gene that had a promoter that needed to be activated, so we could take a well-studied system in yeast like the GAL1 gene, which has an upstream activating sequence, a UAS, and it has an activation domain, a GAL4 activation domain. GAL4 is a transcription factor that has, typically as they have a DNA binding domain, and they have an activating domain. And they're like separate domains, and you can mix and match them. And you can cut them apart and make fusion proteins, as you'll see. But in the natural situation, then, this Gal4 transcription factor would bind to the Gal1 upstream activating sequence, and in doing so, it would activate RNA polymerase here to transcribe the downstream gene, which you can stick on whatever gene you want. The two genes that are used a lot are either LACZ, which codes for beta-galactosidase, so that you can assay the enzyme in the many different ways that we talked about previously, or you can put in a gene for a biosynthetic pathway step that is missing in a particular yeast strain. Essentially, you have all the different yeast strains, but the histidine pathway is a convenient one. So this is the reporter. So if you did this, then the if you put them on rich medium, and then you stain for beta-galactosidase using that blue stain, they would all be blue. All the colonies of yeast that grew up on this would be blue. Or if you put them in histidine-deficient medium, they would grow just as well as if you put them, whether or not you added histidine to the medium, right? Because the gene is on all the time. So that's kind of the background. Now, in the real experiment, you don't put on the real transcription factor. You just put on the DNA binding domain of Gal4 as a fusion protein that you made together with your favorite protein, X, which is the bait. You want to know what is going to interact with X. And to do that, then you can you make a fusion between, let's say you want to test Y. So you make another fusion protein that attaches the activation domain of Gal4 to Y. So this is just floating around now in the cytoplasm and or the nucleoplasm. And this is the prey that you're going to capture with this bait. Right? And so if they interact, then the XY will go together and you'll get this positive result. Alternatively, instead of Y, if you don't know what Y is, and you have no idea what Y could be, you can make a cDNA library by taking your Gal4 construct and cloning in an entire cDNA library, one perhaps that you made sure went all the way to the 5' end using the first thing, using the cap selection I talked about. There's another reason you would want it to go all the way to the 5' end, so you're not losing any information. You're making good coding sequence. So you can take this whole library and put it in and then select. I have more slides about this. So, this I got ahead of myself. So this is what I was just talking about. So the X and Y interact and things turn on. So now only the yeast that have this situation going on will be able to grow in a histidine deficient plate. Only the yeast that have this going on will form blue colonies when stained for beta-galactosidase. Once you have them a clone that grows on the histidine-free medium, you can pick that clone and then extract the DNA, PCR the DNA out of that, and find out, you know, just what Y is. All right, this looks busy. But again, a lot of these slides are just for your own study purposes. Often you do both. You know, you do the blue versus the non-blue for the beta-galactosidase assay here on the right, and you also do the histreporter for whether they grow at all. You'd think the histreporter would be enough by itself since it's so stringent. The trouble is you get a lot of false positives. That is, even though it's not really interacting, somehow the gene gets turned on in a certain fraction of the cells. So it's nice to be able to have two different assays and then take only those that are positive in both assays to invest further work on. And that's what this says here. Is this clear? So that's the yeast-2 hybrid system. It's been used innumerable times. It's very ingenious. And lots of interacting proteins have been found this way. And you know, they could be human proteins, they could be E. coli proteins. It has nothing to do with yeast. Although, you have to say, if you get a negative result, you can always fear that, well, they do interact in a human cell, but in this yeast environment, there are things that interfere with this interaction. Some yeast protein, which is binding, is getting in the way. So a negative result is not so informative. Now there are variations on this theme. So the three hybrid system looks specifically for, I mean, three hybrid here is being used for RNA, but the name three hybrid has been used, as you'll see in a minute, for other kinds of ways of tweaking this system to select for interactions in a different way. Originally, this was designed for RNA binding proteins, isolate RNA binding proteins. So for a bait, you put in a specific protein, let's say the RNA phage protein MS2. So this RNA phage packages the RNA, and this MS2 protein is involved in the packaging. It might even be the capsid of the virus, the bacterial virus. And but it binds very specifically to a certain structure and sequence, the MS2 binding site. So you can make a piece of RNA, then you can make a piece of DNA that will code for this RNA inside the yeast genome, and it will make this this molecule, which has at one end the MS2 binding site, which fits nicely into the MS2 bait, and at the other end it has the sequence in question. You want to know what protein binds to this RNA sequence, which is you suspect of doing something important for splicing or RNA degradation or other functions of the RNA, ribosomal RNAs, for instance. So now you make your fusion protein with the activation domain, and if it's a particular one you're testing, again, you just put a particular one in, or if it's a whole cDNA library, again, you're making these proteins and asking whether they're going to bind to this particular sequence. If they do, then you've completed this bridge. The activation domain can do its job and instigate transcription of the reporter gene. We can go the other way, to the yeast 1 hybrid system, and ask what is a protein that reacts with a particular DNA sequence. Then it's a lot easier, because this, all you do is you put your DNA sequence down in front of your reporter gene, and you put your protein library attached to the activation domain. Again, the same way, but what all you're asking for is whether it will bind to this sequence. So you do away with that GAL4 binding site. And put your own binding site in there. And again, if you successfully transcribe your HIS3, then you'll form colonies if this protein interacts with this DNA sequence. That's the 1 hybrid system. Now you can take the 3 hybrid system and do fancier things with it. These are experiments done in the Virginia Cornish lab over in the chemistry department here. And there's 2 types of experiments done, one more clever than the other. First one clever enough. So she's interested in enzyme evolution. And in this case, they set for themselves the goal of making a polysaccharide or oligosaccharide synthesizing enzymes. That is an enzyme that will connect one sugar to another. And they use as a substrate this fluorinated glucose, it looks like, and whether it can be connected to another glucose. Glucose would make maltose, for example, which is the basic dimer in starch. So the enzyme we're starting with is a glycosidase. But since all enzymes can work forward or back, they work better in one direction in terms of their binding than the other, they want to know if they can turn it around and make it a synthase by mutating it. So here's their plan. Here they use the LU2 gene instead of HIS, but in the same way, it's going to satisfy an auxotrophy. So here they took proteins that are good, strong binders of small molecules, tight binders. So again, the iodofolate reductase pops up because it binds methotrexate, an analog of its dihydrofolate substrate, that it binds with 10 to the minus 10th or better affinity, very, very tight. But they didn't give it just methotrexate. Because it's in the chemistry department, they were able to make methotrexate bound to this fluorinated glucose hanging off here. And they attached that DHFR to the DNA binding domain. To the activating domain, they took the glucocorticoid receptor, so that binds specifically steroid here with its four rings. They used dexamethasone, which is an analog of hydrocortisone that binds even better than hydrocortisone. And to it, they attached just a regular glucose molecule. So they were looking for that, this reaction shown in the previous slide here, to see this connection. If that connection is made, then you have formed the tether again, and you will activate the leucine domain. So you have all these three, four players, really. Two small molecules, special players, and two proteins that are being just taken advantage of here. So you have these sitting in your cell, in your yeast cell, and now you transfect it with a library of mutated glycosidase molecules, hoping among them there'll be a glycosynthase molecule, and if it's so, then they should turn it on. So, and they were able to get molecules. I think they weren't great synthetases, but they worked. So this is clever, but straightforward. Next one takes another twist. Here they're trying to get improved cellulases. The idea may be eventually they'll be able to synthesize cheaply enough cellulase to turn corn husks into ethanol. This is now a cleavage, not a synthesis. So you have to do something special. So they mutate cellulase, which is made in bacteria. They mutate it to make it better, they hope, among their mutated versions. And they have the same kind of system, except over here they've made methotrexate, glucose, attached to glucose, attached to dexamethasone. So it's already tethering. It's already working. It's already turning on this gene. And they want to look at something that will disrupt this turning on, and they want to select for it out of hundreds of thousands or millions of different cellulose variants. So instead of using a gene that will satisfy an auxotrophy, they use a gene which will kill the cell if it's expressed. So that if it's no longer expressed because this has been broken, then the cell will survive. So this is a toxifying gene. This gene is actually URA3, which is codes for an enzyme in the biosynthetic pathway to pyrimidines. Now, if you give the cell uridine, or even uracil, I guess, in yeast, then they don't need to synthesize them. So it's no harm for the cell if you give them uracil. But if you give them a small pro-poison, say, which is not poisonous itself, but if this enzyme acts on it, it will become toxic, then you have a selection against the synthesis of this. Let's see. So this is now what looks like the obvious part. Look at that molecule it had to make, right? And if you have a good cellulase, it will break this, and you'll no longer make this gene. So how does this part work? This is widely used in yeast genetics. Here's the pathway. Glutamine, carbon dioxide, and ATP. You start building up a ring, right? You get carbamyl phosphate. The exact chemistry doesn't matter. Aspartic acid comes in. You get to something that's already a ring here at this step, dihydroorotate, and that gets oxidized to orotic acid, right? And then gets phosphorylated, I guess, ribophosphorylated to as ribose phosphate to orotodilic acid, orotidine 5-phosphate. And then this gets decarboxylated, and I'm not showing you the structures, and that's uridine. Right? So the erotic acid, which is the base part, has this extra carboxyl group on it, and one of the last steps is to decarboxylate it. Orotidine, phosphate, decarboxylate, that's URA3. That's what URA3 does. If you give the cell not erotic acid, but 5, which is the natural intermediate, but 5-fluororotic acid, then it will get ribophosphorylated to 5-fluoroiridine monophosphate. And then your ura3 acts on it, it will become 5-fluorouridine monophosphate, and that is bad stuff. It gets the sugar gets reduced to from ribose to deoxyribose, and now you have 5-fluorodeoxy-UMP. That reacts with thymidylate synthetase, which is the last step in making thymidylic acid for DNA synthesis, and it actually covalently binds this fluoro group being active to the enzyme and just knocks it out. So the cells die unless you give them thymidine, which you don't. So if they have ura3, and in addition, there's a killing action of the uridine monophosphate as well, goes into RNA in some less characterized way, results in cell death. So if only you didn't have ura3, you'd be 5-fluoroiridic acid resistant. Many of these steps we'll go over again when we talk about mammalian cell genetics, and there are analogs. So you have to give uridine because you're depending on the cell becoming ura minus, right, by no longer expressing ura3, so they will require uridine, but that's no problem because this is still going on in parallel to the uridine. Uridine, thankfully, doesn't interfere with this. So that's how that works. So that's all aspects of the EES2 hybrid system, right? Next time, we'll talk about analogs of that in mammalian cells, which I don't think I'll get to today. But to make sure I get to the second subject, which is then measuring protein-protein interaction in vitro, which is sort of more straightforward. So one way is to do co-immunoprecipitation. That's like the most straightforward. Maybe I should just jump to that. Right. So I don't know how well you can see this. Probably not too well. But I can just use it as a basis to talk. So you're looking for whether in an animal cell, let's say, this red and black proteins are attached to each other, associated with each other or not. You break open the cells, and hopefully that doesn't interfere with this. Conditions are still good for these to be together. And now you have to have an antibody against at least one of the molecules, probably both. So using an antibody against both of those molecules. So what you do is you take, you buy an agarose bead that's been coated with protein A. So protein A sounds nondescript, but in fact protein A, the A stands, I believe, for the A in Staphylococcus aureus, as that's a bacterium that produces this protein, and it was found that this protein, for some reason, has, maybe it's a good reason, it was Staph, it's such a bad infection, it's able to bind immunoglobulins. Never actually thought of it this way. That's maybe how it overcomes your immune system. So it binds immunoglobulin G of the G class. Not every single one, but almost any IgG will be bound by its common structure at its base by protein A. So you can buy these with protein A, and then you can make your antibody or buy your antibody against your black protein here, and you mix it with the beads, and now you have a bead that's coated with your antibody, and it's a bead so that you can centrifuge it or put it in a column. Centrifuging is easier. And now you mix it with the cell extract, and so you bind this black guy and then wash it. And then after it's washed, you destroy all the interactions by either boiling and running a SDS page gel, or acid like pH3 will disrupt most antibody antigen interactions. Or there's probably some other ways. And then you run that on a gel, and what you'll get on the gel will be the proteins that came off this bead, which will certainly involve the antibody. So if your particular protein has the same molecular weight as one of the antibody, heavy chain or light chain, then you're out of luck, because you'll get the heavy chain, the light chain, which goes much further, that's about 80,000 and 20,000. And you'll get the protein you started with, the black one, right? And if the red one is in fact there, then you'll see the red one as well. And you just see it directly by its molecular weight, and then you could do a Western blot to confirm that it's actually what it is. So you don't necessarily need antibodies to do this kind of experiment, because you can do all the genetic manipulations ahead of time. So instead of just using your protein, that's the endogenous protein, you can make a gene, a CDNA version of the gene for this protein that's a fusion protein with an affinity tag. So at the N-terminus or the C-terminus, you can put in a sequence for a variety of things. The most popular are these three that I'm mentioning. You could put six histidines in a row. Six histidines in a row will form a structure that will bind very tightly to certain metals like nickel and cobalt. You can also buy nickel and cobalt that has somehow, it seems miraculously to me, chelated in a way that can be attached to a bead. So you're sort of presenting this nickel ion or cobalt ion in its own little cage, and this histidine, six histidines in a row, will still bind to that. It's still available for binding to that. A second kind, so all of these have two parts. They have the part that's on your protein and the part that's on the beads. So in this case, the HIS-3 is obviously on the protein because that's the amino acid part, and the nickel or cobalt is on the bead. You can also put a small, about 35,000 molecular weight enzyme called glutathione S-transferase and attach that whole thing to your protein, and folds up by itself, generally doesn't interfere with your protein. And that has the ability to bind very tightly to its substrate, which is glutathione, which is a tetrapeptide that's present in most cells. It's used to keep things reduced. It's got cysteine in it. So you put that on the beads, and so again, you could pull down this protein that way. Or you could pull it down by using the maltose binding protein, which I think is bigger than GST. That's from bacteria. And it binds maltose, that's a glucose attached to glucose, but it'll also attach to polyglucose, which is like hundreds of glucoses. That's amylose, which is like a small version of starch. And you can buy these beads as well. So you can buy all this stuff. So you don't need antibody in this case, because you've made your protein into something that has an affinity tag. So here you could take, for instance, this, you have your agarose gel with this green thing. Let's say it's glutathione, right? And then you can put your first protein, which is which you make to have this glutathione S-transferase, or GST, and you mix it, and you've made yourself a bead now that has your prey, your bait protein there. And you wash that away from everything. You don't even need to, you know, to purify. You just express it in your cell culture, and then just pull out these beads that are now coated with your bait. And now you take your prey, which has, in this case, you have to be testing a certain one. Okay, I guess you could make a library that all of which have this GST, the GST, yes, GST is the red thing, right? Attached to their ends. You have a GST pull-down library, and pull out, that wouldn't help. That would just pull out everything, right? So you have to, if you're testing just X versus Y, so on Y you put the GST, and then you want to ask whether it's attached or not. So you mix it on, and you see if it's, and then you wash it, and then you disrupt it again. In this case, you could use competition. For instance, you could use glutathione. If it's histidine, you could use this binding. You could use imidazole, which is the ringed part of the side chain of histidine, and that will compete for the cobalt or the nickel, right, to get it off. And then you run a gel, and if you see both, in addition to your bait, you also see the prey. It means that you have an interaction. So here's somebody's experiment where this was what they loaded onto their bait column, and you see a whole bunch of bands. That's a complex mixture. And then the flow through has something that looks quite similar. But then after you elute the stuff that was pulled down by this interaction, you see, there's something, which is the right molecular weight for cyclin T1 or for CDK9 that has the His attached to it. And you can even see in this experiment, in the flow through, you can even see the disappearance, right, in the middle one, a reduction in the amount in the flow through. So that's not usual. So this is just stained with Komasi blue. You can identify, find out what that is by doing mass spec, perhaps. You might see a few proteins at that position. Or you can do a Western blot. For Western blots, you might include epitopes. And if you don't have an antibody against your protein, then that's all you need is to put onto one end of it a peptide for which very good antibodies have been produced and which you can buy, or the whole MYC protein for which there's very good antibodies, or another popular one is hemagglutinin. This is in one of the slides I went through quickly. Hemagglutinin is another protein for which that's from the flu virus, for which there's very good antibodies. And then you can use that as an antibody to detect your what your band is. So I guess you can look at that on your own, I think. Well, no, maybe I'll go over that next time, because we talk about Western blotting casually, but I want to make sure you all know what it is. Yes, so I think I will do those. But I'm going to stop here because I want to make sure you get the homeworks. So we'll finish up the protein-protein interactions next time and then start another topic. So these are due next Wednesday.